This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Hurricane Laura made landfall in Louisiana this morning as a powerful and destructive Category 4 hurricane after tracking across the warm waters of the Gulf. The peak of hurricane season hasn't arrived yet, but already records have been broken for the number of named storms. For more insight on the hyperactive storm season, spaghetti maps and Saharan dust, I talked with Brian Kerrick. Well, Brian Kerrick is the Chief Meteorologist with Spectrum News 13. Brian, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. I know it's probably kind of interesting at this point, getting almost to the halfway point in the season, wondering what's going to happen in the second half.
Indeed, and we talked to you right at the start of the season, Brian, and at that point, the predictions were for an active season, but then things changed again a few weeks after that, and now it's a very active season, and we've seen that over the last month or so, right? I mean, we saw storms forming before the even official start of the season, so that's kind of one out of the books, isn't it?
Yeah, we've had 13 named storms, four of them hurricanes, and it is above our average. Typically, on average, we see 12 named storms in a given season. So we're already above it. We're not even halfway through it. It has been active, and it looks like we will continue to get active the second half of the season. But the thing to keep in mind is those numbers are just that. They are numbers. As we mentioned early on, in the season when we discussed the potential for a very active season, that it only takes one storm to actually cause issues. And knock on wood, so far, we have been spared some of that worst of weather.
What happened to Marco? Did that actually become a hurricane at any point?
Marco was a hurricane for a brief period, and it quickly degenerated into a post-tropical low. And it just hit some shear and some dry air and it fell apart. It really did not get its act together. And it fell apart as it made landfall in the southeastern tip of Louisiana. And so the storm as a whole, it didn't really keep its act together, which is good news for the folks up in southeastern Louisiana.
Those waters are pretty warm at this time of year. And I guess this year warmer than normal, right? So what does that mean for storm formation from here on out? Like, once a storm does actually make it through those straits into the Gulf of Mexico, what can typically happen?
Yeah, sea surface temperatures can range from the mid-80s to the lower 90s. And what that does is this high-octane fuel. You really need about 80 degrees to fuel a hurricane, but you get even warmer water like that, and it just feeds into the system. And so the Gulf is like bathwater this time of year, and anything that can get into the Gulf of Mexico has a better chance of absorbing that really warm water and growing and strengthening. And it can be rapid strengthening as well in these storms that come into the Gulf of Mexico. Some things that you have to keep in mind, though, it's also going to be fighting potential for some wind shear, which is a changing of wind and not only speed, but also in direction with height as you work up through the atmosphere, but also any dry pockets of air. And that's what happened with Marco. It sucked in a lot of dry air and ended up encountering some shear. But in the Gulf of Mexico this time of year, sea surface temperatures are definitely conducive to strengthening hurricanes.
What about up the Atlantic coast then? I mean, how are sea surface temperatures looking there, and what does that mean for storms down the track over the next couple weeks to a month or two?
For our east coast here in Florida, sea surface temperatures are in the mid-80s right now, which is definitely conducive to helping fuel any activity that comes along our coast. You get off about 25 to 35 miles offshore, you get into something called the Gulf Stream, and that is some of the warm water from the Gulf that is actually, there's a stream. If you look at some of the maps and satellites, you can see it coming around the straits and up the east coast, and it goes all the way up off the coast of Cape Cod in Massachusetts, where a warmer area, a warmer river of water continues. And storms do have a tendency to kind of feed off that warmer water, and it's definitely running slightly above average as far as those temperatures are concerned. So as we work our way through the second half of the season, it's just another factor in not only what strength the storm may be, but steering that storm as well.
And we're now at the point in the season where you are likely to get more stronger storms or hurricanes, right? I mean, what are we looking at in terms of what to expect from here on out?
Sure. The peak of the season is September 10th. We usually see our biggest increase in tropical activity right now, running through the middle of August, and then middle of September, and then we see a nice sharp drop heading into October. But what we're starting to pay attention to are those storms coming off the coast of Africa, and they seem to be coming off the coasts with more frequency. The monsoon season over there kicking up, and that's why we had such a busy period, and it looks like we could get into another period where we see those waves come off the coast of Africa, and they ride the entire length of the Atlantic in those warm ocean waters. and have the time to develop. Now, I was looking at some of the extended models, and there are some things spinning up, but as they work their way toward the Leeward Islands, what I'm seeing is that they seem to be running into some sort of a wall with wind shear and dry air. So our fingers crossed that that happens with each storm, but we do have the second half of the season, and for us, it's usually our busiest here in Florida as well.
Talk a little bit about Saharan dust, because I know a month or two back, there was talk about how that was suppressing storm development, right? And we're even seeing the effects of that visually with some beautiful sunsets here in Florida and probably some kind of decrease in air quality. But from the point of view of storm formation, that was a good thing for us. Is that still sticking around? Are we still seeing those plumes of dust come off of the coast of Africa and kind of mess things up a little bit for the storms?
We are, and that is some very good news for us. Each time you get a storm developing in Africa and you get the wind that collapses in storms like we have around here in the afternoon, if a storm collapses, it pushes the wind out. While it's coming across the Saharan Desert in North Africa, that wind pushes down, kicks up all the dust, pulls it all the way into the upper atmosphere, and it's carried across the Atlantic. And it's carried far enough where it has at times impacted our sunsets, made them absolutely beautiful, our sunrises as well, more orange and red. But what that also does is it stabilizes the upper atmosphere and it keeps the storms from breathing. So as the waves come off, they may climb up into the atmosphere and actually hit that Saharan dust or the wind shear that may be encountering, and it keeps it from developing and it actually pushes back down and suppresses. And that's what we've seen in some of these storms that have come across the Atlantic this season alone.
My guest is Brian Carrick. He is the chief meteorologist with Spectrum News 13, talking about the midpoint of the 2020 storm season and what we can expect for the next month or so. Brian, it seems to me that, you know, the storms that we have seen, Isaias and even Marco and Laura, those storms have been a little bit unpredictable in terms of, you know, where they ended up, how long it took them to get there, and even just, you know, the spaghetti models that people are so fixated on at this time of year, right? What's going on there with the modeling, and why are we seeing maybe more, you know, variation and potential tracks of these storms? Or are we actually seeing that, or am I just sort of thinking that's the case?
Yeah, well, and it's funny you ask, because, you know, the spaghetti models first, it is a combination of all the various models that are used in tropical forecasting, and people do get fixated on those because they tend to show a path in a direction that the storms are going to be moving. But you're right in that the season, they seem to be kind of going all over the place. Well, the thing that has been happening, and you know, a good case in point is Laura. You remember early on in Laura's life cycle, we were in the cone of concern and it was aimed right at us. Well, at that point though, and here at Spectrum News 13, we kept going back and forth. It was the same thing with Isaias. This storm may be developing in the models, but it hasn't developed yet a center of circulation that is stacked or anything like that. So we had an area of low pressure, but we did not have the formation of any kind of a depression or a storm. And we took that into consideration and realized that some of the models, the GFS, the American model, picked up on that early on and was doing a pretty good job with the system. So the other models couldn't nail down because they couldn't find that center of circulation. And once the models found that center of circulation, you saw all of the models shift and it take into account a shift south that was out in the northern Leeward Islands. And then all the models started to converge on Cuba. At that point, it was because we had developed that center of circulation and a defined center of circulation through the lower and mid levels. But without that, the models cannot perform. And they are just throwing basically spaghetti on the wall.
What about Isaias too? Because at one point it looked like that storm, you know, once it had kind of tracked into the Bahamas, had almost completely dissipated, right? But then it picked up strength again. That was a little bit unpredictable in terms of its intensity as well.
Right. It was another messy, messy looking storm. But once it got over the Gulf Stream, it fed off the waters that we discussed that were warm. They were in the mid-80s. And so it was able to feed off of that. We lowered the wind shear, and it was able to start to circulate better, get that low and mid-level circulation, and that's exactly what it did. And it did so in a hurry. And then the storm got picked up very quickly in the upper flow and a front coming in from the north. So that pulled it due north at a very fast pace. But that was good for us because it was so ragged when it came across the Bahamas. At that point, we knew that this wasn't going to be an issue for us, that it was going to be more of a concern from the Carolinas north.
When we spoke earlier in the storm season, or actually before the start of the storm season, Brian, one of the things we talked about was the fact that there are fewer commercial airliners flying around now because of the pandemic. and that was potentially having a bit of an impact on predictions. Is that still the case? Are we still seeing maybe a lack of data that you might normally expect to see, especially once a storm has actually spun up? You just don't quite have all the pieces that you might need to get a really accurate picture of where that storm's going.
It is true, and that's probably why we're also seeing some of the model discrepancies in the spaghetti models. We aren't seeing the traffic that we would see in a typical season, and now we're starting to see that pick back up just a little bit, but it's still not to the point where we're getting all that data that we could really use. And so, yes, the models may not be as robust as they were when we had higher traffic in the air and out at sea, but you know, the models have been trying to catch up, and I think as we get into the second half of the season, we will see improvements in that overall. It's just a matter on getting these storms to develop that center of circulation so the models can actually find it. And it's, again, planes flying over a jagged-looking mess of clouds can help us determine if there is a center of circulation or if it's not, and that will have help to kind of loosen up those models a little bit and help in the long run.
You know, we're talking about the hurricane season and anticipating, you know, what would happen if a big storm came ashore and affected our area in central Florida. But if you also get the occasional tornadoes too, right? And we saw that in DeLand, a couple of days of some pretty severe storms, not associated with a hurricane by any means, but still did a lot of damage. What was your take on that sort of little flurry of tornadic activity last week?
It was crazy last week when we had severe weather and the tornadoes. That it was an EF2, which isn't a common thing in the summer. As a matter of fact, in the month of August, we've only had that happen 19 times since records have been kept. So EF2s are typically our frontal or strong winter type storms that to kick up EF2s. Ours in the summer, EF0s, EF1s coming out of tropical systems. It just so happened that we had some boundary collisions, and the sea breezes played a role in that as well. But when you get these storms that are collapsing, you can spin up tornadoes, usually not that strong. And it was unusually strong and on the ground for 4.5 miles. And one of the things that we have now here at Spectrum News 13, we're very excited to be able to use this Klystron 13. It's a brand new radar that can give us a live look at those winds. And so now that we get boundaries colliding and the sea breeze activity, we're going to be able to find those spins a little easier because we're looking into that storm. And so when we have something like DeLand, obviously you want all the notice you can get. And I think we're going to have that tool to do so. But it was an unusual collision of boundaries that led to something that strong.
You don't actually have a lot of time to react when a tornado warning comes through, right? I mean, it doesn't give you a lot of lead time to tell people to get to shelter if they need to.
Right. And in this particular storm, you know, we had some thunderstorms around, some severe weather nearby, but it was just a matter of moments before we had rotation and a tornado touching down. So it didn't really give people that much time to react. And I just, at this time of year, I just tell people you need to just kind of be paying attention, because once those boundaries start moving and you see storms nearby and the wind comes out, there's the possibility we could kick up another stronger storm or potentially something that rotates. So you just want to be paying attention to make sure you're aware of your surroundings, and obviously always carry some form of notification. Phone notifications are the best way to get your alerts if you are out and about and you can't get to a TV.
Given the fact that we saw storms, you know, back to the hurricane season overall, we saw some storms forming before the official start. And I know that can happen, but could we see stuff still happening beyond the end of hurricane season, do you think, this year, Brian?
I don't feel this year we will, but, you know, it's 2020 and just can't put anything past what has happened so far this year. We will get busy as far as the tropics sail. We went through a brief period of busyness. Looks like we'll get into another one probably as we head through September. And October may be just a little bit busier. But again, it only takes one storm. So it could be an active or an above active or extremely active season. And we may not get impacted here in Florida. But the Atlantic Basin seems to be showing that we are going to churn some more up. I have a feeling by November we will start to quiet things down, but I think we'll still see some named storms in the month of November as well. The thing that we really want to focus on moving forward is that we don't want to be scared. We just want to be prepared. And that's the motto we use here. And it helps, because once you're focused, you can focus on just getting your family into a safe place and riding out the storm. And, you know, we're a really solid bunch as a Central Florida community. And so if we get through something, we're going to get through it and we're going to grow and be even better.
Well, Brian Carrick is the chief meteorologist with Spectrum News 13. Brian, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew.
Still to come, Jeff Harvey says a tsunami of evictions is looming for Central Florida. He's hoping an eviction diversion program can help keep a roof over the heads of some of the most vulnerable. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Orange County has started an eviction diversion program in a bid to help stave off what advocates are describing as a potential tidal wave of evictions. Jeff Harvey, CEO of Community Legal Services of Mid-Florida, estimates about 8,000 people are at risk of eviction, but he says the program could help keep a roof over the heads of at least half of them. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if you could just kind of take a minute to explain what the involvement is of the Community Legal Services of Mid-Florida as far as helping folks deal with evictions at this point in time.
Yeah, so we've actually been around for 50 years and have been doing eviction defense work for low-income and vulnerable Floridians in the Central Florida area for that entire time. But as it relates to right now, you know, with the pandemic and a lot of people being out of work or reduced in work, limited mobility, you know, evictions are significantly on the rise. I think in Orange County alone, they're anticipating somewhere around 8,000 possible evictions that could take place. And so in Orange County, and they've done this in a couple of other counties that we operate in as well. But in Orange County, they've set aside that eviction diversion fund to try to help offset people that have back rent. And so our role with this is to really be the advocate for the tenant. You know, Florida law is very landlord friendly. Basically, if you follow the rules, and even in certain cases, if you don't follow the rules, you can get an eviction within 5 days. You can have the final judgment, and within less than a week, you'll have it served and the tenant will be removed. And Florida's been called what's a pay-to-play state, which means that you've got to put the money of the back rent in the registry of the court in order to even really defend yourself. And so in this situation where people can't make rent, you know, that you really got to have an advocate for them, especially if it's not, you know, your landlord-tenant relationship where, you know, you got a buddy who lives in the house and you know, just one piece of property, you know, kind of single owner or maybe a quadplex. But when you start talking about these large, massive management companies, that the tenants are basically just a number and a revenue source, you've really got to have somebody that does a few things. One, that they look at all of the processes in place as an eviction goes through to make sure that they're not, that their rights aren't getting violated. But more importantly, that when we're having conversations with landlords, especially as the county is kind of encouraging with this funding, you know, to effectively have everybody take a little bit of the burden off of themselves, right? So you're behind, you know, $4,000 in rent. Let's say you're behind $5,000 in rent. Well, based on this program, the landlord's got to accept $4,000. The tenant's got to be able to show that they can pay 2 months going forward. Maybe they can pay something. Maybe they can't pay the original lease amount. And so, you know, who's going to help have that conversation and basically advocate for that tenant to say, hey, look, my tenant can pay, you know, $300 a month, but they can't pay $600 a month. So maybe for the next 2 months, we agree to $300 a month, because it's better to have somebody in there that's trying to get back on their feet than to have nobody in there. You know, one of the big kind of lurking crises that we see, I think, it's going to be a ripple effect. And I kind of call it, you know, I call this whole thing like the legal tsunami that's about to hit. And it's really the process right now of starting to hit Central Florida. We already have an affordable housing crisis, but now we run into this situation. And so let's say, you know, of the 8,000 people that are up for eviction, this program saves 4,000. There's still 4,000 families that are going to get evicted. Once you get an eviction on your record, you can't rent anywhere else. You're not going to be able to afford a mortgage or get qualified for a loan. So what are you going to do? You're going to become homeless.
If I could ask you about the number, then that 8,000 figure, and you kind of threw out a potential, you know, for this program to help like at least half of those folks, Do you have a sense of how many people this program could help? Like, is that like a realistic number, do you think, 4,000 people?
It is. And these are estimates, right? You can never really tell exactly. But there's been, roughly speaking, between 800 and 1,000 evictions filed on a historical basis per month in Orange County.
Right.
Right. So if you think about the moratorium that started the end of March, let's call it April, May, June, July, August. That's 5 months worth. So there's 5,000 evictions that should have been filed just based on historical. Now you're in September when the moratorium ends. So there's 6,000 right there that you're going to get in a normal economic times. Add to that the reduction in employment and some of the issues that people have had in getting unemployment and getting the additional assistance that's come from COVID. You could really get to about 8,000. I mean, it pretty quickly. Now, when you look at the funding, and I've been in constant communication with the county on this as kind of a partner in this program, and you're asking me to do math, but basically they said, right, the maximum amount you can get is $4,000, and there's $20 million available. So when we did the math, I want to tell you that was 5,000 there. The hope is that, as we stand as advocates and as we try to work things out with landlords, especially if they've already filed the eviction, we can say, maybe they don't need the whole 4,000. Maybe they'll settle for, 2,700 or something like that. Or maybe they're only behind 2 months of rent, which was the requirement to get in the program, and that's $3,000. Every dollar that gets saved that doesn't go towards that particular incident can go towards another instance. And so that's where I say, 4,000, 5,000 is probably a reasonable number if we go through this. I don't think it'll completely solve the problem, but I've already heard rumors of, a second round that we're looking at potentially. But the other problem is that what's causing this hasn't stopped, right? I mean, people still are having work issues, people are still having economic issues. But back to that kind of large catastrophe, let's say you have 8,000 and 4,000 get helped and the other 4,000 don't. Now you have 4,000 homeless. There's also, while there's an affordable housing crisis, if you just remove 4,000 people from the housing situation, you're going to start to run into an issue where you can't keep the apartments full because there's not enough qualified people in Central Florida that can actually get a lease. And so it'll solve the affordable housing problem, but it'll significantly reduce rents, and you'll have a significant amount of homelessness that then the county's back on dealing with. So, I mean, I do have to say that the county is great in being proactive on this. It's just that, we've got to step in and help because it is very much landlord friendly, and it's much more difficult for the tenant to go through this process.
This is a good step, as you point out, but it's a temporary thing. The pandemic hasn't eased up. The economic downturn is not picking up yet. We aren't sort of anywhere near back to where we were before the pandemic. How do you see the role of community legal services of Mid-Florida going forward? I mean, do you feel like you're going to be doing a lot more eviction prevention work or advocating for folks who may be homeless, 6 months down the track?
I think so. So, and you and I talked before this briefly about, military background. So my role in the National Guard, right, I'm no stranger to disaster work. I have been, right in the front for Hurricane Michael and Irma and even, Dorian. Thank God it didn't really impact us too much. And so I've seen what those communities look like 2 days after the hurricane, a week after the hurricane, and then working here, I get to kind of see what is the impact at the 6 month mark. And there is literally a life cycle on, first it's basic necessities like food and shelter, and then it becomes issues like insurance issues and FEMA claims, and then it turns into consumer claims. You're going to see the same trend with this. The problem is this is like a hurricane that's lasted for months. So you haven't even stopped the damage, let alone start to recover. So, I do think we're going to see a significant increase. I mean, we've already seen a significant increase in the last few months just in unemployment claim issues and people applying for, public benefits in order to kind of help support their income. That's, income really means food and it contributes to shelter, right? Shelter is next. So now we're looking at evictions. I think add a few more months and we're going to start talking about foreclosures. And then, while there's not the damage, so you're probably not going to see as many consumer issues come out of this as you do when you've got bad contractors and those types of things post-storm. What you are going to see is a lot of desperate people that find ways creatively to help their situation and take out bad loans. You know, they've got an eviction on the record now, they've got bad credit, so they're dealing with an unscrupulous lender. And so I still think you're going to see an uptick in those as well. So, I mean, I see definitely an increase of workload for us over the next at least 2 years.
Long term, what are the chances, do you think, Jeff, of some kind of change to the nature of the landlord-tenant relationship in Florida? I mean, could this become a more tenant-friendly state out of necessity, or do you think it's going to be business as usual, you know, 2021 and forward?
You know, I don't know. I thought about that. And one of the things I even thought about with this program was, hey, what if somebody didn't know about the program and the landlord filed the eviction and everybody would qualify for it, but you don't have the money to put in the registry of the court, but you have a resource to get money, but you can't get the money until you can get the landlord to come to the table. Is there a mechanism to do that? You know, I'd like to think that, people are looking at those types of things and realizing that the laws as written have caused, in some cases, difficulty in the government's ability to solve its own problems in this type of scenario. You know, so you have Orange County trying to help. We also have legal rules that don't even let you have the conversation take place. So I'd like to think that some of that stuff will evolve, but when it comes to the rest of it, you know, I really can't say, you know, it's how well this program and programs like this work out, I think will really tell. I do think that there will be an increase in work for us. I do think that there will be a lasting impact in the community that'll take a couple of years to fully recover from. But my hope is it's a lot smaller than the initial tsunami that we had predicted, and that you know, while it's still going to affect, I think, a ton of people, I hopefully it won't be everybody. You know what I mean?
Do you have enough staff to deal with the workload, do you think?
I don't. So, you know, there were 1 million people in my 12-county service area that financially qualified for assistance. There's another 1.5 million that would qualify for assistance, not from financial, but from some other circumstance, disability. They're a veteran, they're, you know, a victim of domestic violence. So, you know, you're looking at between 1 and 2 million people that we could be serving. While I have a staff of 60 lawyers, it just, you know, if you take that 2 million and divide it with the 60, right, it's an unreasonable caseload. So we've partnered with the Legal Aid Society of the Orange County Bar Association for this Orange County project, just to join forces and try to get this worked out. You know, we're having some challenges with the funding for them, but I believe that's something that we'll be able to work out with the county pretty easily, hopefully in the next day or two. But we don't have enough. And Florida is one of the only states where there's no direct legislative, I think one of three, where there's no direct legislative funding for legal assistance. But laws and rules have gotten so complex, you really can't navigate even the civil system without advice from an attorney. So, you know, our focus has been on volume, trying to find the best way to get the most information to people so they're making informed decisions and they're selecting the right options. I mean, it's never enough. So we rely heavily on volunteers, and we're looking to get volunteers to help with this all the time. And there are a lot of good pro bono attorneys that have been working with us for a long time, but we definitely could use more.
Are there a lot of lawyers who are graduating from law school and going into this field of work, or is it something, are you concerned about the future from that point of view?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you've paid attention at all or not, but there are a whole bunch of law graduates that are waiting to take the bar now that's been postponed twice, and I know that they're working on that.
That's right.
There is a program that the Young Lawyers Division of the Florida Bar is actually working on, and I had a call with one of their members the other day, and it's pretty promising. They're looking to raise money for these law graduates. And basically, you know, it's not going to be a lot, but it's going to be something. That combined with the Supreme Court's recent directive that they can kind of qualify to certify legal interns, which allows us to supervise them, but let them practice kind of as a mentorship, apprenticeship, if you will. you know, that's a promising program, and that's something we can get off the ground. I mean, I think that'd be great, because once you get exposed to this type of practice of law, it's not the same as the private bar. It's not, the clients are different. The ethical issues are different. The resources are different, and you really have to get creative, and it always go with compassion, because a lot of clients are frustrated, and they're frustrated at the system. And the first thing they want to do is take it out on you, because you're the first person that's going to listen to them. And you gotta really put yourself in their shoes, but also get them up to the level that you need them, so that they are made, because they make their decisions. All we do is coach and counsel, right? So that they're making those decisions and they're selecting the right things. So I hope that program does work out. You know, I've already spoken to a bunch of other directors and the other legal aides, and we're all very interested in leveraging that pool of talent to kind of help with this. But that, some of that's a funding issue and a coordination issue that's still yet to be worked out.
Jeff Harvey, Chief Executive of Community Legal Services of Mid-Florida, thanks so much for your time, and good luck as this program rolls out.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate you having us, and if anybody needs help, they should reach out to us over the phone or on our website. It's clsmf.org. And if there's any volunteers that are interested in helping the fight, they are welcome to come and contact us that way as well.
Still to come, the pandemic, the recession, the summer of protest, divided politics, these are all stressing people's mental health. Eric Welch of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Greater Orlando talks about who's most at risk and what resources are out there to help. That's when we return. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The pandemic, with the threat of deadly disease, social isolation and disruption to daily routines and the economy, is stressing people's mental health. But the pandemic is just one stressor, and the National Alliance on Mental Illness is one organization that's stepped up to help. NAMI of Greater Orlando Executive Director Eric Welch joins us to discuss who's most at risk and what resources are available for those in need. Well, Eric Welch, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome back to Intersection. It's been a while.
Thank you, Matthew.
So this has been a challenging few months, right? I mean, the pandemic, the stress of, you know, fear of this potentially deadly disease, coupled with isolation, coupled with all of the other challenges inherent in this pandemic, whether they're emotional, economic, physical challenges. What does that mean for mental health, and what has it meant for you all at NAMI of Greater Orlando over the last 4 or 5 months?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is when I started bringing these statistics to people, I said, you know, the mental illness epidemic is coming. And I think we're starting to really see the beginning of what our chief medical officer said was an epidemic that will have its own waves and intensity. I think we're starting to see that now that the summer is over. There are just pieces of this mental health crisis that we've seen across the board. Here at NAMI Greater Orlando, of course, our call volume has gone up. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline's call volume has gone up. There was a national distress line, you know, so all of that, people are being really in touch with their own stress. And in fact, Matthew, that just recently there was an article on USA Today that said 40% of us are showing at least one negative impact of mental health. I think that's a little low, but, you know, we're at least saying it's 40%. And when you take that to our young people, ages 18 to 24, it's 75%. So really seeing, as always, this stress is hitting our young people, who are the ones that are, you know, the social time of life, right? We're taking away the social time. So it's hitting our young people more than ever.
There was a study that came out fairly recently, Eric, sort of delving into some of the practical implications of that, right? And the risk of suicide rising amongst young folks particularly. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that study and, you know, what that tells you about that impact.
It was the CDC study, Matthew, and it just came out just recently that said 1 in 4 young people are now considered suicide since the pandemic. And that, you know, normally is maybe, you know, 1 in 10, that kind of thing. So we're definitely seeing an increase, and back to that suicide lifeline, you know, the lifeline has just experienced a massive increase in calls these days, to where, you know, and it all comes down to when we're having mental health issues, you know, we all know this. When we're having an issue, where do we do it? What do we do? We go and get with our friends and we hug each other and we support each other. It's a natural thing to do. And when you start taking that away, the younger people don't have quite the resiliency, maybe, and adults are struggling with it too, but don't have that resiliency and are now struggling maybe more than others.
What are some of the things to look out for? Say you're a parent, you're worried about your kids, they may be embarking on remote schooling or even heading back to campus and worried about what the future holds for them, you know, not just this semester, but beyond that. What are some of the things that you need to be aware of and looking out for?
We always talk about intensity and duration, right? So if somebody's been down for quite something, we're all going to have waves of depression and, you know, today's a down day, but, you know, waves, in long, intense waves of is a warning sign of down for a long time. The basic things, sleeping habits, eating habits, you know, if you're looking at your young person or your child, you know, is there something that's just really out of the ordinary? And we say, you know, as far as what can we do as parents, just try to maintain that routine the best you can. There's a lot of distance learning going on right now. So if it means getting up 8 o'clock, eating breakfast, you know, packing a lunch like you used to, whatever it is, try to maintain that routine for the health of the family, helps out with the mental health throughout the day.
You know, given the restrictions around social distancing and some of the health concerns about getting too close to people physically, you know, what are some things you can do that go beyond, you know, a phone call or a Zoom conference?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really been interesting to see how much eye contact we're making with people at Publix these days, right? Naturally, we want to reach out. We want to hug people. And so we're doing this whole connecting, bonding, having these conversations, saying, hey, good job, Publix bagger, right? You know, the things that we've maybe never done before, we're all taking that extra effort to be connected, compassionate, you know, give people a little bit of extra time and everything. But in these worlds of, I think it's just amazing, you know, that we can even Zoom. Imagine if this was 10, 20 years ago, right? The fact that we can Zoom and have these eye-to-eye conversations is important, and we can see each other and connect the best that we can. And that's my advice, is to just keep connecting in whatever works for you. And you mentioned phone calls. I wish I had this stat, but I did hear that, but I know that phone calls are up, you know, that all the old school stuff is up, you know, puzzles is up, game night is up, right? The things that, and that's another thing, if you can connect within your own family unit, your own, you know, we've all created our own mini bubbles, that's healthy and that's important.
Young folks are obviously a point of concern, something that you all at NAMI are keeping tabs on pretty closely. But what about the elderly too? Because when you think about isolation, I mean, that's a concern too. And one of the challenges, of course, when sometimes your primary means of communication at this point in time, the pandemic, for example, has been via your computer, via Zoom. I mean, sometimes those things are a bit of a challenge for older folks who just aren't so comfortable using that kind of technology.
But when managing stress, it always comes into four different categories. We always know our physical, you know, workout, that kind of thing, emotional, social, and spiritual are the four big categories. So when you're talking about the elderly, it's just making sure that each one of those are taken care of, you know, that physically, you know, if it's somebody that's in an assisted living, hopefully there's some physical activity going on, right? And then the emotional connection, the social connections. And what's really interesting that's going on, there's kind of a spiritual reawakening, and I don't want to necessarily say it's church or whatever, but everybody's sort of getting in touch with the, why am I here? What is my purpose? How do I fit into this whole COVID thing? All of those things combined is what helps, no matter what age you are, helps you find your place throughout all this.
I'm wondering too, just from the point of view of your organization, Eric, what has the last 5 or so months been like? Because, you know, you would think that an organization that deals directly with mental health would be pretty well equipped for this, but has it been a bit of a struggle for you all?
Yeah, we're the education group, so our mission is education through classes and support through support groups. So a lot of ours is getting together, is getting people together in a classroom or getting people together in a support group. So we've seen the additional challenges of having to give support through Zoom, and we've been inching back into face-to-face social distancing with masks, all that stuff of getting the people the support they need, of course, has been an extra challenge. But what we do know, as I said, our phone volume is up and more of the people that are calling for support than ever. They want to know, how can we get support? And we have our families helping families, our peers helping peers, throughout Central Florida.
And one of the other concerns, I think, too, for especially nonprofits in this time is, what does the kind of financial future look like? I'm wondering, from NAMI's point of view, are you sort of a little bit trepidatious about the next kind of 6 months to a year?
I think everybody is. We'd be a little, we're looking. Luckily, we're in very good shape. We've had some major grants throughout that kept us in pretty good financial shape. We do, and I think you may remember, we do an annual signature event that is a walk, and that normally is 1,000 people together. And this year, it was what we're calling hybrid. That's one of the new fundraising terms, which is a hybrid between an in-person something that we put online and our fundraising. And we did pretty well. You know, we raised over $130,000 towards that walk, towards to keep our mental health programs going. So we're living to fight another day, as I say, but the trepidation, I think, is there for all nonprofits, not knowing what donors are able to do with the unemployment and all that's out there. We have to remind everybody that mental health is health. It is one of our most important things that we have to take care of right now. And the more education and prevention we can get out there, the better.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Eric Welch. He's the executive director of the Greater Orlando chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Eric, you know, I think the pandemic, from speaking to epidemiologists and folks who deal with the physical side of this disease, one of the things that the pandemic has shown is some of the limitations and the restrictions on our healthcare system, right? I mean, there's obviously a lot of potential in the healthcare system in the United States and the ability to, you know, come up with a cure or a vaccine for the virus, but there are also some challenges, right? From a mental health perspective, I'm wondering how much time you've had to sort of think about the bigger picture, like on the other side of this pandemic, what do we need to do to sort of move forward and support mental health care in the United States?
Well, certainly, you know, funding is an issue across the board. And we say it every time. Florida is one of the lowest, depending on who you ask. It's 48 to 50th in direct mental health spending. So in a world where we're all looking now at what budget cuts are going to look like, mental health is not the place to touch. And we actually need more than ever. In terms of counseling, I will say it's been really amazing to see what I like to call our mental health heroes. You know, you hear about are the heroes that are the first responders, but our mental health heroes have been checking in on people. They've, you know, free of cost. They've been doing, figuring out how to do counseling and therapy over the phone, via telehealth. You know, what I see this future is a real trending, like we're saying to now, towards what is that telehealth going to look like? What are those check-ins going to look like now that everybody probably needs, you know, a check-in now, whether it's a professional or personal, where, you know, we all need those check-ins, and especially those that are in ongoing counseling, you know, need to make sure that they're stable. With what I've seen a lot of is just a very quick pivot to help those in need.
Mm-hmm. As far as thinking about that challenge and the resources that you're going to need in the future, how much of it is on you as the leader of, you know, the Central Florida NAMI, and how much does it come down to what the national organization is doing in terms of, you know, going to the federal government sort of cap in hand and saying, look, we need more resources for this aspect of healthcare?
Yeah, it's a partnership across the board. You know, the whole all politics is local. So, you know, we spend a lot of time with our Orlando leaders, and I will say, across the board, you know, in our walk, we had every major Orlando leader giving me a 30-second, you know, keep doing what you're doing, and we're behind mental health. So here locally in Orlando, we're very blessed that our mayors and law enforcement are all behind education and prevention, including, you know, we should mention, you know, law enforcement is a big issue these days, and the crisis intervention training that that our law enforcement officers get to for de-escalation and learning about mental health is more, it's more important now than ever.
Does NAMI have a part to play in that?
Yeah, we, what we do on that is we bring in family members and people with lived experience who come in and tell their stories. So we're sort of storyteller group of all of that, but we're certainly a part to play in the, we need more training and we need to think out of the box a little bit on when somebody shows up at a call, is it a co-responder? There's all kinds of different models that are out there, but we need more of that. And the, according to the experts, we're going to need even more of that. I'll give you an example. The UCF Police Department does a co-responder ride along during peak stress times. You know, we don't know that, but of course they do during finals week and that kind of thing. If there's a mental health issue, they'll have a counselor and a plainclothes polo, that type of person, you know, respond. Those are the type of models that, you know, that that we would be behind. You know, anything that, the bottom line is we want to see people get the help that they need and be, and not be, and be diverted from, you know, the judicial system and get they need to go. And that goes into the funding, you know, but that means we need more beds in our behavioral hospitals. You know, that gets into the, we got to have a place to put people. And if we're really seeing this epidemic over the next 10 years, as we all kind of think we might, and of what is mental health point, what is this going to do for our mental health over the years? We're going to need the resources allocated to tackle it.
Eric, that's a rather startling statement there. You're saying that, that what we're experiencing now in 2020 could have like a 10-year tail on it?
Well, when you think, and that's another one of the, I love the Dr. Duckworth, when he talks about the flattening the curve, the mental health curve is going to have a longer tail because in terms of things like PTSD and trauma, and I bring up Pulse. You know, we, every time we have a Pulse anniversary here, our community goes through yet another grief cycle, and that's been what, 4 years now? So so we know, you know, we sort of know that in trauma world, in grief counseling world, people will have their own peaks and valleys, and it may be 3 or 4 years down the road before we see the results of that.
There are so many stresses right now, right? I mean, we have the pandemic. We have, we're in hurricane season here, and that's of concern to Florida residents specifically. You know, what are some practical advice you can give for folks who are like looking at all these giant things and saying, well, you know, what do I focus on? What should I be worried about? How can I deal with the stress of some of these things that I don't have control over?
Well, as a newsmaker, you're not going to like this, but the answer is turn off the news sometimes. Like, you don't, we have 24/7 news, and I don't think that we were ever meant to hear the stressing bad news 24 hours at a time. So off the news, go outside, walk around, understand that there are lots of things out of your control. And I heard something the other day that's called radical acceptance, which every day it is what it is. Like, there's many things that we can't control. And you talked about all those different stressors of when, what's going on with COVID, and when is our tourism industry going to come back the way it should, all the things that we stress about, you know, what, just in my world, what's football going to be like, right? I mean, we don't know yet. So just being able to give yourself just a few minutes of, it's okay, I'm not okay, you know, but we're going to pick up and go on. I think everybody needs to do that. Even you talk about the stress of working remotely. You got parents who are dealing with children and work and everything around, you know, this right here, their whole world is right here.
Yeah. Zoom fatigue is real.
Here's one thing on the Zoom part, just to interact and maintain focus and listen takes more effort than a face-to-face talk.
Eric, anything else you want to add?
I just would remind everybody that there is hope and there is help out there. Our phone number never closed. So if you're needing extra help or you want some resources, you call us at 407-253-1900. We continue to bring the message that mental health is important. And all of our programs are free of cost to anybody that needs them.
Well, Eric Welch is the Executive Director of NAMI, Greater Orlando NAMI, of course, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Production assistance for today's show from Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And you can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everyone free of charge. That service is as important today as ever, and it starts with your gift. Visit wmfe.org to make your contribution, and thanks. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.